taking it hard, as you might expect. She'll speak to you, but she asks for a few minutes to gather her thoughts. Of course. As we approach the village, I expect a loose cluster of buildings like the first settlement. Instead, there are a few small outbuildings clustered around two large ones that remind me of indigenous longhouses. Communal living, I murmur. I think I've said it low enough, but Tomas hears and smiles.
Yes, it's more economical for heating and food. Everyone works together, whether it's cooking or child rearing.
He glances to the side and a smile grows.
Speaking of child rearing,
a little girl, maybe 5 or 6, comes racing over and throws herself into Tomas's arms. He swoops her up and swings her about as she squeals. I notice a boy 1 or 2 older eyeing us. Tomas waves him over.
These are my children, he says. Becky and Miles.
Eric,
Dalton says. He shakes the boy's hand. The girl just giggles, but when I introduce myself, she shakes mine. They aren't really interested in us, though. Both pairs of eyes are fixed on our furry companion. I introduce Storm and have her sit while the children pet her.
Can you guys do me a favor? Tomas asks. Your mom is busy right now, so I'd like you to stay with us. We're going to speak to the elders.
And if you can keep Storm company while we do that, we'd appreciate it, I say. Then to Tomas, I add, she's very well trained and will be close by. He nods and charges the children with watching the dog, which really means just walking along beside her and petting her while we all enter the first longhouse. A campfire within is the main source of light, and it takes a minute for my eyes to adjust. As I look around, I remember once going to a park with recreated Iroquois longhouses. That really is what this reminds me of. Down the center is a workspace where women sew and children play and men whittle. Bunks line the walls, 3 high. Drying herbs and vegetables hang from the ceiling. At the back sits a group that I'm guessing are the elders, since they're talking rather than working. The eldest is in her 60s. That makes sense, given that the second settlement launched in the 70s. At the first settlement, we're always met with a combination of curiosity and hostility, emphasis on the latter. It's saber rattling. They want us to know how strong they are, how well defended. A pissing match that we must engage in, or we're the submissive wolf rolling over to show our unprotected belly. In the second settlement, we get curiosity tempered by caution. While Tomas's daughter ran out to see us, her brother held back, and that's what many of the adults do. They withdraw, physically and emotionally, stepping backward to let us pass, their faces blank. Even in their caution, though, there is politeness rather than aggression. You are welcome enough here, but please don't stay long. Others are more like Tomas and his daughter, the friendliness outweighing any reserve. They smile and they nod as we pass, and I do the same in return. Storm's presence lures a few of the children closer, especially when they see Tomas's kids petting her. I get her to sit a few feet from where the elders wait, and the children surge in, with adults supervising. There is another thing I notice as we walk. Signs of, well, the words I consider and reject are religion, faith, ritual, belief. It's not as if I'm seeing crucifixes or dharma wheels or anything I recognize, yet my brain still identifies them as signs of a ritualized faith. There is what appears to be an altar built of stones and filled with dried grasses that add a sweet, pleasant scent to the campfire smoke. Other stones line the walls, each carved with an unfamiliar symbol. I see ones that look like stylized versions of wind and rain and snow. I also spot animal carvings, too many to be mere toys. And the sleeping berths bear more carvings, some symbols and some animals. I struggle not to draw conclusions from what I'm seeing. Take in the data and store it for processing once I have more information. I don't get more information on this by speaking to the elders. Well, I do, and I don't. It's not as if they extend a ritual greeting or ask that we all bow our heads in prayer before we speak. But there is a calm here that reminds me of a church, a hush and a peaceful contentment, and a reverence in the way Tomas addresses the elders. I may not see religion and ritual,
but I feel it. The conversation itself is a ritual I know very well. We have been presented to the leader, Myra, and she welcomes us, and we extend our greetings and explain our purpose. She expresses sadness at our news, gratitude for our attempts to find this woman's people, and promises of cooperation. It's like when I dealt with crimes involving an organization of any kind, social or political or business. Yes, this is a terrible crime, and of course, we're here for anything the police need to solve it. Honest intent or empty promises? That's always the question. And if I was to hazard a guess based on my experiences, I'd say that the second settlement isn't going to actively block my investigation. But they're not going out of their way to help it either. Ellen isn't theirs, and since she'd been shot, and they forbid guns, her death isn't theirs either. The meeting lasts about 15 minutes, and it's nothing more than a formal exchange of information and promises. As we leave the longhouse, the women at the cooking pit press food into our hands, fresh stew in beautifully carved wooden bowls and hunks of warm bread. They give some to Tomas, too, for himself and his wife, and we all thank them as we depart. When we're out of the longhouse, Tomas quietly offers to switch bowls with us. In case you're at all concerned about the contents, he says. I spent a lifetime with my paranoid brother. I would understand if you'd prefer to eat what they gave me. We assure him we're not worried, and he passes his bread to the kids, who trail along after us with Storm. I'm going to ask you two to go back into the big house. He says to the kids. He looks at us. May they take the dog? Of course, I say. The girl starts to give Storm her bread, but Tomas pulls her hand back. Never feed an animal anything that she might not normally eat. It can upset her stomach. Ask Josie if they have bones instead. Big bones from caribou or moose. The dog will like those better. I motion for Storm to go with the kids, and she gives me a careful look, as if to be sure she's understanding. Then she lets them lead her back into the longhouse. Tomas takes us to what seemed like a storage building, small and round. As we approach, I see smoke rising from it. As much as we believe in communal living, we also understand that sometimes privacy is required, and in the winter, we can't just head into the forest to find it. This is our alone hut, for individuals and, he winks, couples. Nancy will meet us in here. It's a hide-covered structure, and he pulls back the flap. We have to duck to go inside. It's brighter than the longhouse, though. There's a fire and a hanging lantern. A woman sits on the floor. She's about my age. Tears streak her face, but as soon as the flap opens, she jumps up to greet us. Tomas waves her back inside. We enter, and he hangs back, as if uncertain. She tugs him in, and his face relaxes with relief. She takes one bowl from him and sets it down on the ground, and they sit, her hand entwined with his. We introduce ourselves. I'm sorry for your loss, I say. And down south, that would be a cliche, but it really does say what needs to be said. All that can be said when talking to a stranger. Nancy's eyes fill. Tomas grips her hand tighter, both hands wrapping around it. She sees we aren't touching our food and says, Eat, please. I won't, but you should. It's good stew, and the bread is even better. We take a few mouthfuls, and both are indeed excellent. Once I've had enough to be sure my belly won't rumble, I say, I'm not sure how much Tomas told you. I was a homicide detective down south. She frowns and glances at Tomas. Nancy hasn't been down south, he says. She was born in the second settlement. He quickly explains what a homicide detective is, and her brows furrow as if she's struggling to understand the need for such a job. I say as much, lightly joking. She nods and says, I know it's different down there. There are so many more people. It's good that they have people to do that job. But Tomas said Ellen was killed by accident. We hope so, I say. Right now I'm trying to piece together her final days. She had something with her, something I need to return. I'm sorry I can't say more than that. Her lips curve in a wry smile. Because whatever this thing is, it's valuable, and if you say what it is, people here might falsely claim it. Probably not, I say. But we need to be extra cautious. We understand, Tomas says. We'd like to do whatever we can to help Ellen. Nancy hesitates at that, and her gaze drops just a little. But then she nods and squeezes her husband's hand. Yes, anything you need. She was a dear friend. She didn't live here, though? Nancy shakes her head. We asked her to. She looks up at me. I know nothing of how a detective works down south. I realize it is a job, and therefore you might want only the details that will help you.
Just the facts, ma'am, Tomas says, and we exchange a smile for a joke the other two won't get.
Down south, we're on a schedule, I say. People's taxes pay our salaries, so we need to be efficient. Brutally efficient, even. Up here, it's different. Eric and I can't get home tonight anyway. As long as the settlement doesn't mind us setting up our tent nearby, we're in no rush. Here, I have the luxury of time, and I appreciate that. It gives me a chance to get a better understanding of the victim. In other words, take your time. Anything you want to explain, I'd like to hear. All right. If I go too far off topic, please stop me, but I would like you to understand more about us, too. It isn't as if we saw Ellen struggling to survive and closed our doors to her. We don't do that. I understand. We've helped a few of the wild people. Some in our community disagree with that. We believe in harmony with nature, the spirits of the forest and all that live in it. We hunt, of course, but we don't interfere with other predators, which includes the wild people. The question we disagree on is whether interference includes helping them escape their situation. She shifts, getting comfortable, and Tomas pushes blankets forward to let her lean on them. She smiles at him, and it is the smile of a long married couple. Instinctively understanding what the other needs and still able to appreciate these small acts of kindness. Ellen and I spoke often of her past, Nancy says. I've taken her story to the elders in hopes of convincing those who say we shouldn't interfere with the wild people. Ellen herself, though, would not speak to the elders. She was conflicted on this. I'm not sure how much you know about the wild people. We're helping a woman who left them recently, I say. She's a former Rockton resident. Eric knew her. He grew up there.
Oh,
her eyes widen as she looks at Dalton.
You're the boy, the one Tyrone spoke of.
Dalton nods, his jaw set, and Nancy sees that, murmuring,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to pry. I just remember Tyrone's stories.
Ty has plenty of those, Dalton says. Not all of them true, but yeah, I was born out here and taken to Rockton.
She rocks back, as if stopping herself from comment. She reaches for her bowl instead and takes a spoonful of stew. Then she stops, frowns, and pulls a shotgun pellet from her mouth.
Thought you folks didn't use guns, Dalton says.
We don't, she says. But sometimes we still find pellets in the meat. When other settlers injure large game without killing them, those end up in our food.
It's been happening more and more recently, Tomas mutters. Someone cracked a tooth just last month.
I reach to take the pellet, but Nancy tucks it aside as if she didn't see me reaching. I hesitate and then withdraw my hand wordlessly. I resume our conversation.
So we know this woman, Marianne, and her situation.
She left Rockton with a party of would-be settlers, and they were set upon by the wild people. The men were killed, the women were taken.
Oh,
Nancy's hand flies to her mouth, her eyes rounding.
I'm sorry.
That isn't how they recruit around here, I ask.
Not Ellen's group. The wild people actually rescued her. Ellen and her husband were up here mining. They were new at it. It was only their second season. They were crossing a river swollen with spring runoff when they fell. He drowned. She made it to shore, but all their supplies were gone. She was nearly dead when the wild people took her in.
And she stayed with them. Nancy looks at her husband as if unsure how much to say.
Tomas makes a face.
That's the problem. They have these T's. They're like ours, but not like ours.
I've heard about the T's. Wait. You said they're like yours? He nods.
We have two. There's the peace T.
He looks at me. Have you ever smoked weed?
Once. I quirk a smile.
It wasn't quite my thing. Slowed me down too much.
Right. That's what it does. Relaxes you, makes you happy and peaceful. We have a tea like that for relaxing. The same way someone might have wine with dinner. Then there's the ritual tea. There's this root that grows wild here. I have no idea what the real name is, but we call it the dream root.
A hallucinogen?
Yes.
We use it for ceremonies, to bridge the gap between us and nature. He lifts his hands as if warding off comment.
Yes, I know.
Between that and the peace tea, it sounds very 1960s.
But we have our ways here, and they don't harm anyone.
I wasn't going to question, I say. Tomas chuckles.
Tyrone sure did. He thought we were a bunch of loony hippies dancing naked in the woods. Our ways were definitely not his.
These teas, though, I say. I'm told the wild people have two as well. One that makes them calm and one that causes hallucinations. Are they the same?
I'm no scientist. I was a truck driver down south, but from what Ellen said, I think theirs are stronger versions of ours. Much stronger.
Ever tried peyote? I shake my head.
I have,
he says.
That's what our ritual tea is like. We drift into a dreamlike state, hence the name. What the wild people takes makes them, well, wild. Increased violence, increased sex drive. Their version of the peace tea is also stronger. Between the two brews, they seem to make the wild people stay with the group. Ellen had family down south, parents, siblings, friends, a job. She only came to the Yukon for an adventure that was her husband's dream. She had no interest in staying long term, let alone permanently.
Nancy nods. But the tea made her forget the rest. Her family, her job, her life. At first, she stayed with the intention of getting well enough to travel back to the city. Then she just forgot all that. How did she come out of it? I ask.
Nancy glances at Tomas, uncomfortable again. This time, he isn't quite so quick to answer, but rubs his beard and looks back at his wife.
There are rules, Tomas says. Every community has them. Ours is no different. There are laws meant to protect us, and there are laws meant to protect our way of life, to put our belief into deed.
Religious prohibitions, I say. He makes a face.
I wouldn't call what we practice a religion. I guess it is, but I was raised Catholic and,
he exhales.
Call it what you will. A friend with far more education than me said it's a belief system rather than a religion. Part of that belief system is non-interference. We don't interfere with Rockton or the First Settlement. We don't interfere with nature either, any more than is needed for survival.
Then you don't interfere with the wild people, I say. Or you're not supposed to. But there's some differing opinion on whether they've actually chosen that lifestyle. The woman we know was clearly a hostage, at least at first. And after a while, she was still hostage to those T's. Her free will was being held hostage.
Yes, Nancy says. Ellen stayed by choice, but at what point was it no longer a choice? If she chose to drink the tea and it caused her to stay, does that mean she chose to stay? Some here would say yes. But drinking the tea is a requirement for staying in that group. And it isn't as if she realized she was losing her free will and chose to keep losing it.
Tomas chuckles.
Nancy's better at explaining this. It makes my head hurt. All I know is that it doesn't seem right, leaving them out there like that. If they don't have the, what do we call it down south? The mental capacity to choose.
Like seeing an addict on the street and not getting them to a shelter because they initially chose the drugs.
Exactly.
So what you're trying to say, I hesitate, considering their situation and reword it.
In a case like that, someone might choose to help a person when their community says they shouldn't. If their community learned of it, they would be in trouble. Neither speaks, but both give me a look that says I've guessed correctly. Okay, I say. How Ellen extricated herself from the wild people is unimportant. You say your community has helped some of them. I'm guessing that means they've offered assistance to wild people who have voluntarily left their tribe. That is allowed. That's not interference. Nancy nods. If they leave on their own, we can offer food, trade goods, even shelter. Two of our members were former wild people. Ellen wanted to live on her own and, when she was ready, travel back home. She left her group the summer before last, and she hoped to return home in the spring. She was so excited. Nancy's voice catches. Tomas puts his arm around her shoulders, and she leans against it. I eat more of my now cold stew and glance at Dalton. He's been silent, letting me handle this. When he catches my eye, he nods, and I'm not aware that I'm communicating anything to him. But after a moment, he speaks.
When's the last time you saw her?
He asks. Nancy starts, and it might be surprise at Dalton talking, but it's more, too. She's sinking into her grief, and we finally reach the heart of what I really must ask her. We can't let her drift now. That's the message Dalton read in my look. This is going to be tough, and I need help. I need someone to push, someone to play bad cop. When Nancy hesitates, Dalton says,
This is important.
I know, she says. It was eight, another catch. 8 days ago. She needed supplies.
Like what?
Dalton grills Nancy on specifics. It isn't easy. Speaking of Ellen in the abstract had been fine, but now Nancy must dissect what she realizes is the last time she'd ever see her friend. Tomas glances at her, concerned, but he doesn't interfere. And Nancy gives no sign she needs to stop. Ellen had come by on a supply run. She did that weekly. As a lone settler without the time to build a permanent residence, she lived light, with only a tent and a pack. It was easier for her to trade weekly with the settlement, giving them her extra meat and furs in return for dried vegetables and other foodstuffs. Her last visit, however, had been unscheduled. She usually stopped by on what they called the sixth day, Saturdays. This visit came on a Tuesday, and she'd brought an entire caribou plus 3 hares, hoping to trade for winter blankets and scraps of leather. Dalton frowns.
She lived alone last winter, and this one isn't any colder.
She said she used last year's blankets to sew summer clothing.
Why now? It's been fucking freezing for 2 months.
They both flinch at the profanity, and it takes him a moment to realize it. He nods, understanding. There are people in Rockton who take exception to his language. If they're troublemakers or chronic complainers, he might even pile on a few fucks to annoy them. But if they're good people like these, he holds back. Nancy admits she doesn't know why Ellen suddenly wanted extra warm blankets. There's hesitation, suggesting she found this odd herself, but Dalton only nods, as if accepting her explanation. Then he says, his voice casual,
A caribou and 3 hares. She must be a really good hunter.
They say nothing, but their discomfort is palpable.
That normal for her? Bringing so much meat 3 days after her last visit?
Silence. Dalton's gaze cuts my way, bouncing the ball over. I know you trade with a very limited number of people, I say. I'm guessing Ellen was an exception because she's a former wild person, in need of help. They both nod, as if grateful for the easy answer. What about others, I say. Regular settlers who need assistance.
It would depend, Tomas says. We'd never turn away someone who was in desperate need, of course. We make exceptions, but only in emergencies, and then we direct them to other sources, such as the first settlement.
What if an accepted trade partner, like Ellen, brought you goods from someone else? They exchange a look. That would be prohibited, Nancy says, by our laws. Which Ellen knows. She'd never risk your friendship by openly trading on someone else's behalf, but if she says nothing, they don't answer. Dalton surges forward, clearly ready to press the matter, but I shake my head. I consider for a minute, and then I say, Ellen was a good friend, yes? And also a good person, it seems. If she knew of someone in need, she would trade for them and not tell you. I respect that. However, given that she is dead, possibly murdered, I need to pursue this. I'm not asking you to confirm that she was trading for a third party. But did she give you any idea what she needed those leather scraps for? She said she was going to try her hand at sewing. Did she need a specific size of scrap? Nancy shakes her head. I had scraps no bigger than my hand, and I said they were useless, but she took them. Did she request anything else? Anything unusual? Salve, she says. For her lips, she said. Were they chapped? Nancy shakes her head. Scraps of leather, any size. When we were diapering Abby, we used fabric scraps for extra padding. That could suggest Ellen was caring for the baby herself. But she hadn't requested anything she'd need to feed Abby. The mention of salve, however, reminds me of a colleague joking about his wife putting lip balm on her nipples during nursing. That would suggest Ellen wasn't caring for the baby herself. She was helping Abby's parents get supplies they needed.
About that caribou, Dalton says. Did she usually bring in game that large? She said she got lucky, Tomas explains. We didn't question. How did she usually hunt? With a gun?
Oh, no, Nancy says. The wild people don't have guns. They're like us. And we allowed her to hunt on our territory, which means she isn't allowed to use guns. She wouldn't anyway. She only traps and fishes. She hesitates, as if seeing the problem with that, given that Ellen brought in a caribou. Had the caribou been shot? I ask, trying not to glance at where Nancy tucked away the pellet.
She brought it partly slaughtered, Tomas says. She kept the head. She said she wanted the antlers, but I suppose if someone gave her the animal, it could have been shot in the head. That's what I figured. That someone traded the caribou to her and she was trading it to us, which wouldn't break our laws. I hadn't thought of it being shot, but I suspect that's the caribou they used for the stew today.
The stew with shotgun pellets. We run out of questions shortly after that. We know Ellen had made an unscheduled stop in the second settlement, trading for unusual items and using unusual payment. That supported the idea she'd been helping Abby's mother. That might also suggest Abby's parents were responsible for the caribou Ellen brought in. They'd shot it and removed the head so it wouldn't be obvious that someone else killed the beast. From what Tomas said, though, it wasn't the first time they discovered pellets in their meat, and that's been more common lately. Had Ellen been working with Abby's parents for a while? If so, wouldn't someone have realized the pellet shop meat all came from her? I might get more answers by tracking the source of the stew meat, confirming it came from that caribou. But when I ask if I can personally thank the cooks for the meal, Nancy shuts me down. Oh, she's polite about it, saying she'll pass on my appreciation, but I know when I'm being blocked. She doesn't want me speaking to them, just like she didn't want me having that pellet. I get the latter, though. I surreptitiously scoop it up while the children bring Storm to show their mother. We wait outside as the children say their goodbyes to the dog. While they do that, I pull the pellet from my pocket for a discreet, closer look. It's a buckshot pellet, the same kind that killed Ellen. Chapter 32. Tomas takes us to a place where we can camp for the night. As expected, there's no invitation to stay in the settlement, but we wouldn't have accepted one anyway. We do take the food they offer, along with Tomas's help locating a well-situated campsite. The site has obviously been used before, and recently, with only the lightest layer of snow over a campfire circle, log seats, and a spot cleared for tents. Tomas says it's for the teens and unmarried adults who need an escape from the close quarters of the longhouses. As I watch Tomas leave, Dalton says,
"You want to go after him?"
before I can ask. "Something's up," I say. And it's not just that shotgun pellet. I think Tomas had an affair with Ellen. Dalton's brows shoot up, and his face falls with,
"The bracelet. Fuck."
He mutters a few more curses, and I understand his disappointment. Nancy and Tomas seem like a deeply committed, loving couple, and no one wants to think a guy who has that at home will betray his wife. But I suspected it from the moment his eyes lit on that bracelet, the flash of grief as he realized who died. Asking us not to mention the bracelet cemented my suspicions. This isn't a polyamorous relationship where Nancy knows what he's doing and approves. I'd just like to follow him, I say. See if he takes a moment to find his game face before he heads back to his wife. You and Storm can come along, but I'd appreciate it if you hang back. He nods, and we set out. I leave the snowshoes. The forest here is dense enough that I can jog through the light snow. Soon, I see Tomas trudging along ahead. I slow to keep out of sight and follow him for about 100 feet. After a glance, he makes a left off the trodden path. I slip after him, tracking his jacket in the fast-falling twilight. Finally, he comes to a clearing where he sits on a fallen tree. Tomas pulls the bracelet from his pocket and runs his fingers over the leather. Then he clears the snow, digs a shallow hole, and lays the bracelet in it. His hand touches the discarded dirt, ready to refill the hole. After a pause, he takes the bracelet out and runs his thumb over it. His head drops and his shoulders shake, racked with silent sobs. I glance over my shoulder, but see no sign of Dalton and Storm. They're there, just giving me room. I look at Tomas again. As a person, I want to leave him to his grief. As a detective, I cannot. I have a murdered woman, and now I'm looking at her secret lover, whose wife tried to hide a shotgun pellet that may have come from the murder weapon. I step from the trees and say, I'm going to need that bracelet back. Tomas jumps. I have my gun lowered, but his gaze still goes to it and his eyes widen. We're alone in the forest, I say. I'm not about to demand murder evidence without a gun in my hand. I put my hand out. How about you give me that instead of burying it? Burying? Another widening of the eyes. Then he winces. Burying the evidence? No, that wasn't what I was doing. It's just maybe not evidence of a crime, but evidence of a secret. A lover's gift. He nods, his gaze still down, shoulders hunched as he sits with the bracelet in his hand. I wanted to bury it. Pretend it never happened. But that isn't fair. It isn't right. This was...
His hand closes around it.
Important.
So what were you going to do with it?
He exhales. I don't know. I should talk to Nancy. That's the right thing to do, and maybe I'm a coward, but I just...
He opens his hand again.
I shouldn't pretend it didn't happen. Nancy and I need to discuss why it happened. I want to protect my family. Down south, I had girlfriends and lovers, and that's all I thought there was for a guy like me. Then I met Nancy, and she's so much more. A friend, a partner, a lover. And now,
he takes a deep breath.
I just don't want Nancy to think I blame her.
Blame your wife for you screwing around?
I should hope not.
He looks up in genuine confusion.
Screwing?
A short laugh.
Of course that's what you thought. That's how these things normally go, isn't it? I wasn't having an affair with Ellen.
But you wanted to, I say. You gave her that. He shakes his head.
I'm not the one who gave it to her.
There's a moment where I don't understand. As soon as I do, I feel stupid. I also feel very close-minded. My brain drew what seemed like the obvious conclusion because it's the one that fits the norms I was raised with. And even if I'm long past that, my mind still follows that long carved path. I remember Tomas's pain on seeing the bracelet. I remember how he'd hesitated, coming into the tent with Nancy, how he'd hung back and made sure of his welcome before comforting her. It was behavior consistent with a man who'd cheated on his wife. It wasn't, however, what I'd expect from a man who just discovered his wife had been cheating on him. You knew, I say, about Nancy and Ellen. He forces a wry smile.
I might have barely gotten my high school diploma, but I can figure some things out just fine. I knew they were more than friends.
He takes a deep breath.
I thought it was a fling. That bracelet means it was more. Nancy loved her, and I didn't expect that.
Finding out your wife was having a fling with a woman must have come as a shock. That twist of a smile again.
Such a shock that I went crazy and shot Ellen? The redneck trucker, so horrified by the thought that his wife prefers women that he destroys the evidence? How? I knew what Nancy was when I married her, and
his face screws up in pain as he rubs his hands over it.
Growing up, my friends called gay people fags and homos. Did I stop them? Hell no. I chimed in because that's what we were taught. That homosexuality was wrong. When I was 20, a bunch of us were at a bar and my friends went after a gay guy. We beat the shit out of him just because we were drunk and spoiling for a fight, and he seemed a perfectly fine target. After I sobered up, I realized what I'd done and I was sick. I didn't exactly start joining gay pride parades, though. I just stopped caring about other people's sexual orientation. Then along came Nancy, and I still didn't care, but in the wrong way, you know?
You married her knowing she preferred women. He nods.
It's not acceptable here. We might be all about nature, kindness, and love thy neighbor, but we must procreate. And for Nancy to say, sure, I'll have babies, but I'd rather be married to a woman, was not an acceptable workaround. Her parents caught her with a settler girl, and they offered her in marriage to this other guy, and Nancy said she'd rather marry me.
He flails his hand.
I was a 25-year-old man who figured he wasn't ever getting a wife because he wasn't born here. Then this 18-year-old girl is in trouble, and she wants to marry me, and I like her, and I know this other guy's a jerk, so I say sure. Look at me, a damn hero stepping up like that. A hero, though, would have taken her out of here. Taken her back to Rockton and let her go down south to be with someone she wanted.
The tears start again, and he looks away, bracelet still in his hands. I remember their obvious love and affection for one another, and I know they've made the best of a difficult situation. Nancy just needed more, and she tried to get it without hurting her husband. I don't see wrongdoing on either side. I see tragedy. The question I must ask, though, is whether one tragedy led to another. Led to murder. I don't question Tomas further. There's no point. He knows he's a suspect. He may even realize Nancy is. And something tells me he'll protect her even more than he'll protect himself. I tell Dalton about Nancy and Ellen. He says,
fuck, that's a mess all around.
He's right. Everyone loses here. And for what? As Tomas said, marrying a woman wouldn't have stopped Nancy from procreating, if that was so important to the settlement. They never gave her that option, though. Which means that, like most of those objections, the justifications were just excuses to backfill a decision rising from ignorance rather than rational thought. However enlightened the second settlement is, they'd still brought their prejudices with them, because those who made this law had grown up in the same world as Tomas, where it was fine to insult and beat homosexuals because they needed to be scared onto the right track. The settlement elders had given Nancy an ultimatum, and she made the best of it. Choosing her own husband. Tomas knew he wasn't her actual choice, but he went along with it, driven by those old prejudices too, the ones that doubtless whispered that if he was a good enough husband, Nancy wouldn't miss anything. Only she did. Ellen comes along, they become friends, and then more than friends. And Ellen winds up dead. Tomas might have said he understood, maybe wanted to understand, but when he first found out, had he seen red, grabbed his forbidden shotgun, and hunted down his rival? Or did Nancy do it in a lover's quarrel? Perhaps she expected to go south with Ellen in the spring, and Ellen told her no. Or Nancy didn't want to go south, so Ellen threatened to tell Tomas about them. Where does Abby fit into this? Nowhere, I realize. Nor does she need to.
Ellen was helping Abby's parents. She might have been looking after the baby when she'd been shot, and with Abby hidden under Ellen's coat, her killer never realized they'd almost claimed a second life. Solving Ellen's murder may not find Abby's parents, but it is still justice for one victim I found in the snow. The big clue here is the shotgun. I suspect that someone in the second settlement is cheating on the no firearms rule. They've gotten hold of a shotgun and been shooting their prey and then jabbing in an arrow, making it look as if the beast was brought down with a bow. Does the entire settlement know someone's breaking the law? Are they turning a blind eye because it's winter and meat equals survival? Nancy knows what's going on, though. I'm certain of that. She knows who has a shotgun, and that's why she tucked away the pellet. Is it Tomas's shotgun, and she's covering for him? Or has she only figured out that someone in the village is using a gun and she's protecting whoever it is? I need to find out who has that gun. Chapter 33. Dalton and I are talking around the fire when we hear running footfalls. We shine our flashlight and a voice huffs, "It's Tomas," sounding out of breath before he appears. He bursts in and stops, panting.
"Nancy's gone. I got back to the village and went to speak to her. When I couldn't find her, I thought she was avoiding me. Miles said she told the kids to stay with the other women, that she needed to find Lane."
"Lane?" I say, and it takes a moment for me to remember that's his nephew. Where is he?
"Hunting. Lane struggles with village life. His mother died when he was a boy, and his father passed 5 years ago, and he lost his best friend the summer before last. Lane's had a rough go of it lately. He spends most of his time hunting. Nancy and I worry about him, but the elders tell us not to interfere. He's the best hunter we have."
"Because he's not using a fucking bow,"
Dalton mutters.
"What?"
Tomas says, sounding genuinely surprised. "Someone has been hunting with a shotgun," I say, "while pretending to use a bow. That's why you found so many pellets in the meat. Nancy figured out it was Lane, and now that Ellen has been killed with a firearm," Tomas's eyes widen.
"You think Nancy's gone after Lane?" "Oh, I thought,"
he swallows.
"I thought that was just an excuse to get away, that she was distraught over Ellen. Lane would never hurt Nancy, but we still need to find her. It hasn't snowed in 3 days, and there are too many prints for me to track. You'd mentioned your dog can do that."
"She can," I say, "but she'll need—" He's already pulling a shirt from his pack. He manages an anxious smile.
"I used to watch a lot of cop shows."
"All right, then. Let's go." Storm picks up the trail easily. According to Tomas, Nancy rarely leaves the settlement in winter. The rest of the year, she loves to walk and gather berries and nuts and greens, but in winter, she hunkers down with her needlework. It's been days since she's been beyond the perimeter, so her trail is easily followed. It's only 10 p.m., but it's been dark for hours. All around us, the forest slumbers, and every step we take seems to echo. It also means that every noise Nancy or Lane makes will do the same, and we've been out less than 20 minutes before we hear their voices on the night breeze.
"You made a mistake," Nancy is saying, her voice low and urgent. "I understand that. That is why we don't use guns, Lane, and when we do, we make mistakes even more easily because we're unaccustomed to handling them."
"I still don't know what you're talking about,"
Lane replies.
"A gun, the one you got in a trade from those people. You've been using it to hunt. I told you that you needed to be more careful. If you wanted to do that, then you couldn't hunt on our territory where someone could get hurt."
"And I told you I don't have a gun."
"I found pellets in the hares you brought us last week. I showed them to you."
"And I said they weren't mine. It's like the elders say, sometimes they get into our game from other hunters."
Nancy's voice rises in frustration.
"I'm trying to help you, Lane. You tell me you don't have a gun? All right, then take that gun that I'm clearly imagining and get rid of it. Please, hide it somewhere."
"I don't have—"
"Stop, Lane. Just listen to me and protect yourself. This woman from Rockton, her entire job is finding people who kill others. Your uncle told me all about it. She's trained to find murderers by studying blood and bullets and dead bodies. If your gun killed Ellen, she won't understand that it was a hunting accident. She'll find the gun and know it's the one that killed Ellen. Then she'll read your fingerprints on it. But if there's no gun, you're safe.
I don't have a gun.
Then who does? I say, as I step into the clearing, gun in hand. Besides me. Nancy staggers back, Tomas rushing in to catch her. His arms go around her and he tugs her out of the way. Storm growls beside me. Through the woods, I see Dalton soundlessly slipping behind Lane. If this was a hunting accident, then I will understand that, I say. Like your aunt said, you lack experience with firearms. But like she also said, I can indeed connect your shotgun to you and to the pellet that killed Ellen. There's no point in arguing it wasn't you. Just explain what happened. If you made a mistake, then it was only a tragic accident. It wasn't. I'm certain of that. I might not be a forensics expert, but I know Ellen died at night. The only thing Lane had been hunting at that time was Ellen herself. Step one, though, is getting a confession to the killing.
I don't have a gun, he says.
Then who does? Has someone you know been giving you their game? Trading it? This makes no sense, but I'm giving him an out here. Dalton's behind Lane, still tucked into the dark forest, his gun drawn. I have mine out, too. Lane's face says he's 2 seconds from bolting, and I need to give him an explanation that will allow him to relax. Then I can get the truth. Still, he shakes his head and says,
I don't know what you're talking about.
Nancy breaks from Tomas's arms and steps toward her nephew.
Lane, please, she says. I know you're scared.
I'm not scared, he says, jaw setting. I don't like being accused of things I didn't do.
Nobody is accusing you, I say. We just want to know what happened. Give us that, and this will be over.
Listen to her, Nancy says, taking another step toward him.
Nancy, I say, move back, please. She shakes her head, her gaze still on her nephew.
I know you'd never hurt me, Lane. You are a son to me, and I trust you completely.
I don't like her tone or her words. They're too much. Her gaze fixed on him, her voice low and soothing, and it's exactly what I've done with dangerous suspects. I know you don't want to hurt me. You don't want to hurt anyone. You're not that kind of person. Words I'd said when I knew my suspect was that kind of person, but I was trying to defuse the situation while my colleagues kept their guns trained on the suspect. Half the time, the suspect called me on my bullshit. Yet I continued doing it for those where my words did nudge something deep in them, did convince them to surrender. This is what Nancy is doing here, except she's not a trained officer. And the fact that she's doing it tells me Lane isn't a sweet, harmless young man. I sneak a glance at Tomas. His face is taut, gaze fixed on his wife as he rocks forward, torn between pulling her back and not wanting to set his nephew off. His gaze cuts my way, communicating exactly what I expect, a warning and a plea. Nancy, I say, I know you're trying to help, and I know Lane would never hurt you, but I have a gun and my dog is trained to attack. Any wrong move, however unintentional, could get both of you hurt. Just step back and let us handle this. Lane isn't armed. He's not going to hurt himself. He's listening to us. I just need you to- Lane lunges, and there's nothing I can do about it except bark at him to get back. Get the hell away from Nancy. He grabs Nancy and yanks her to him, and Tomas lunges toward them, but Lane already has his arm around Nancy's neck, a hunting knife in his hand.
Why?
Lane screams at his uncle, spittle flying. Tomas falls back with the force of that scream, the venom in it. Even Dalton startles. Storm growls, hackles rising.
Why do you care?
Lane screams at Tomas.
Do you mean why do I care about you?
Tomas says.
You're my nephew, my brother's child. You're a son. I mean her.
Lane shakes Nancy.
Why do you care what I do to her? You knew what she was doing.
Tomas swallows. And when he says, I'm not sure what you mean, it's obviously a lie.
That wild woman. Your wife was.
He can't finish, his face choked with rage.
She betrayed you with a woman.
Nancy's gaze shunts to her husband, but Tomas straightens, voice calm as he says,
That would be between my wife and myself, Lane. Yes, I knew, and I've done nothing about it, which means it is none of your concern. She betrayed you.
I don't see it like that. Lane snarls.
My father always said you were a fool. He told me about her.
He shakes Nancy again. How you married her even after she was found with another girl?
You were a fool then, and you're a fool now, but you're still my uncle. You were good to me, better than my father ever was. You were good to her, too, and we don't deserve it. But at least I appreciate it. I care about you. I won't stand by and watch you be humiliated by your wife.
Tomas goes still, drawing in ragged breaths.
Lane, let her go, please. If you really do care about me, you will let her go. I love you. I'll help you no matter what you might have done. What I might have done?
Lane's face contorts in a sneer.
You know what I did. I did what you couldn't.
Lane, I say. Stop right there. Whatever you are about to say, consider it before you do. Let Nancy go and we can talk. I'm not giving him a free pass. Once he speaks those words, though, he tumbles over a precipice. Admit to one murder and it'll seem easy to commit a second.
I don't want to stop,
Lane says.
Why should I? I'm not ashamed of what I did.
Lane, I say. That's enough. Let Nancy go.
Yes, I killed that woman.
Shot her and left her to die.
She deserved it. And so does this filthy excuse of a...
Dalton grabs Lane's knife arm. He'd been sneaking up from behind. Lane so intent on his confession that he never realized Dalton was with us. Now Dalton yanks Lane's arm back, the knife dropping. I run for the weapon. Tomas runs for Nancy and pulls her from the scuffle. Dalton wrestles with Lane. I can't do more than stand back, my gun aimed. I could threaten to shoot Lane, but he's in such a frenzy I doubt he'd hear. I could hardly follow through either with Dalton lost in that blur of blows. Dalton goes down, his knee buckling under a savage kick. Lane wheels and runs, and I lunge after him, but I'm too slow. My bad leg will never let me keep up with a fit young man. I see Storm. Lane is running across the clearing, past where Storm's huge black form blends into the night. Her gaze swings on me, a question in it. I instinctively raise my hand for her to hold her stay. Then I remember my thoughts from earlier. Storm is a working dog, and I need to use her.
Go,
I say, pairing the command with a wave that releases her. She's off like a shot. She isn't built for speed, though, and she has to give chase. The two of us running after Lane, oblivious to whatever is happening behind us. Storm closes her gap as I fall behind, my bobbing flashlight beam allowing me only glimpses of them ahead. Storm catches up, and she's right behind him, and I think she'll have no idea what to do next. Which proves, I suppose, that I really am a fretful parent, worrying about what I haven't prepared my child for. My child is a dog, a predator. No one needed to show her what to do when Charisse posed a threat to me, and no one needs to tell her what to do when she catches up to Lane. One powerful lunge, and she's on him, knocking him face down in the snow. It's the next part that confuses her, as it did with Charisse. She's been taught not to hurt people. Even in play, she can never snap or snarl or growl, even grab an arm with an intention of clamping down. She's too well-trained here. Those teachings overcoming instinct. She takes Lane down and then just stands on him and looks back at me, but I'm 50 feet away. Lane flips over, shoving at her even as I shout a warning. Lane scrambles up and Storm knocks him down again. He slams a fist into her chest and a snarl of rage behind us tells me Dalton is coming. Yet he's too far back, and so am I,
and Storm's trying to figure out what to do, butting at Lane while he hits her. I have to clamp my jaw shut not to call her back. I'm almost there. Lane's unarmed and a flash of silver. He has a knife. Storm! I scream, which is not a command, not a goddamn command at all. Come! Storm, come! The knife slashes. Blood sprays onto snow, and I scream again. Then something bursts from the forest, a blur of gray. I'm only 10 feet away, close enough to see what it is. The wolf. He grabs Lane's arm, his teeth clamped down, but the young man's wearing a thick parka, and the wolf only hangs there. He bites hard enough to startle Lane into dropping the knife, though. Lane realizes there's a 100-pound wolf hanging off his shoulder, and he screams, kicking and punching. I'm there. Finally, there. I ram the flashlight into my pocket, holster my gun, and grab Storm's collar to drag her back. I ignore Lane. I know he's my target, but there's blood in the snow, and it belongs to my dog, and that's what matters. The wolf can take Lane for all I care. Lane and the wolf fight, battling with growls and grunts and gasps of pain. Storm whines, her body trembling as I run my hands along it. She flinches when I find the spot where the knife went in, but she doesn't stop straining to see the fight, nudging me out of the way when I block her view. The blade sliced her left shoulder. The fur is wet and sticky with blood, and I tug out the flashlight for a look. It's a slice, not a stab. And as I palpate the wound, she huffs in annoyance more than pain. Mom fussing over a scraped knee when her child just wants to run back onto the playground. That reassures me even before I get a good look at what is indeed a flesh wound. A shallow slice, maybe 2 inches long. It'll need stitches, and I'm sure as hell not letting her jump into the fight, but she's all right. I see Dalton then. He's circling Lane and the wolf, looking for an opening. His knee gives a little when he faints too fast, telling me Lane really did give it a solid kick. The wolf and Lane are squaring off, circling each other. Dalton outside, looking for a way in. Looking for a way to get between Lane and the wolf. Oh, hell no. I pull my gun. Lane, get on the fucking ground and we'll take care of the wolf. Lane's gaze darts my way. You heard me, I bark. On the ground, now. He spins and kicks at Dalton, aiming for his wounded knee, and rage fills me. The kind of rage that let me shoot Blaine Sartori. The kind that had me put a bullet through Val's head. But I learn. Each time I learn because I can never pull this trigger and not question afterward. With Blaine, I have every reason to question. I made a mistake. With Val, I did not. But I still suffer for it. Wonder if there'd been a way to protect Dalton without killing her. This time, there is no question. Dalton isn't in lethal danger. Lane is just really, really pissing me off, trying to literally throw Dalton to the wolves. So I shoot, but it's aimed over them. The gunfire startles Lane, and it warns Dalton. And between the two, Lane's kick is aborted as Dalton dodges. Lane comes out running as he tears into the forest. The wolf starts to go after him, and my idiot lover leaps between them. No! Dalton shouts, startling the wolf, which skids to a halt. Dalton's bigger than Lane, and he's making himself bigger still, puffed up, gun out, shouting at the wolf. Personally, I'd let the damned beast go after the bastard. But this is why, no matter which roles we play best, the good cop is the guy in front of me. The canine stands his ground but shows no sign of attacking. Storm is fine, and her attacker is gone, and the wolf himself seems all right. He approaches Storm, stiff-legged, and we let them do the sniff greeting again. Of course, he's hoping for a reward from his rescued damsel, but this time, as soon as he sniffs behind her, she snarls and spins away. And after one more half-hearted try, he lopes into the forest. Sorry, I say. No reward sex for you. I turn to Dalton. And definitely none for you. What the hell was that? Coming between a confessed killer and a wolf? He pauses and then says, I was worried about the wolf. Right answer. I lift up to peck his cheek.
even if it's utter bullshit, and you just saw a dangerous situation and decided to play hero by leaping into the middle of it.
I didn't actually leap in. I was looking for a way to break it up.
Refereeing a wolf fight? I shake my head. I don't think the wolf would have listened. Hell, I don't think either of them would have. I look in the direction Lane went. So, I guess we're stuck tracking him.
Is Storm okay?
He bends to pet the dog, and I hand him the flashlight and point out the damage. I should stitch her, I say, but we have surgical strips in our packs at camp. That'll do. We just need some way to mark this spot so we can pick up Lane's trail after. Dalton digs into his pocket, and I'm about to point out that tying a marker to a tree won't work at night. Instead, he pulls out a package of surgical strips. The man comes prepared, I say as I take them.
Do I get reward sex for that?
You just might. Now hold her steady while I clean the wound and plaster it shut. Chapter 34. Once Storm's fine, we track Lane. It's easy at first. He doesn't have a flashlight or a lantern. In winter, under a three-quarter moon, the reflection of the snow is enough. However, that leads to a quandary for Lane. More open land means better light, but deeper snow. His choices are clear sight or easy movement. He tries both, racing through thicker woods and probably tripping over an obstacle or two until he veers to less dense forest, and then staggers through knee-deep snow. Eventually, he finds a happy medium. He's still walking through snow, though, meaning we barely need Storm to track him. At some point, he must realize that, and he heads for the foothills. There, he finds windswept rock to run across, and Storm earns her keep then. Ultimately, though, we lose him. Storm is wounded, and she's been up since her wolf suitor came to call yesterday morning. She isn't the only one flagging, either. When Lane plays one too many tricks on us, we run out of the patience needed to keep Storm on target. We also run out of the will to push her when she's so obviously exhausted. Lane has confessed to killing Ellen. He's a threat to Nancy, but while I won't say that's the Second Settlement's problem, I have no jurisdiction here. The dead woman was their friend. The killer is their resident. I have no right to keep investigating. I will if they ask for help, but I have a baby mama to find, and solving this crime doesn't get me any closer to resolving that one. When Dalton came after me, he told Tomas to take Nancy home. That's where we go, and it's 7 in the morning by the time we get there. It'd have been longer if we backtracked, but I'm blessed to be with a guy who doesn't need to follow his own footprints to find his way in the forest. Tomas and Nancy haven't told the elders anything. They're waiting to talk to us, and I fear that means they want us to cover for Lane. They don't. He didn't kill Ellen in self-defense. He has no excuse and no remorse, and he followed up one cold-blooded murder by attempting another, this time against the woman who raised him. I can blame a twisted sense of loyalty to his uncle or the homophobic teachings of his settlement, but neither is an excuse for murder. Whatever his father and the settlement taught him, Tomas and Nancy raised him in a loving and open-minded home. We speak to the elders with Tomas and Nancy. Lane will face their judgment. They'll wait for him to return, protecting Nancy and the children, and if Lane doesn't come back, then yes, they would appreciate our help finding him. Afterward, Tomas and Nancy ask us to join them for breakfast before we leave. The children feed Storm, who is doing an excellent impression of a fur rug, sprawled on the snow, refusing to move. Apparently, she's getting breakfast in bed, and I have no doubt she'll rouse enough to eat it. I wouldn't mind an hour of sleep myself before the long walk home, but I can also rouse myself to eat, and I know Tomas and Nancy want to talk to us. We're barely settled into the small alone hut when Tomas says,
I would like to ask for transportation down south. For my family.
What? Nancy says, startling enough that she nearly drops her breakfast bowl. Tomas doesn't look at her.
We'll go to Whitehorse. I should still have money in an old account. It'll be enough to get us started. I'll set up Nancy and the kids someplace outside the city where they'll be more comfortable, and I'll rent an apartment and find work in Whitehorse.
Did I miss our discussion on this? Nancy says, because I'm quite certain I'd have remembered it.
Tomas folds his hands in his lap.
I should have done this 12 years ago. Taken you away instead of marrying you and tying you down with—
With our children? Her voice rises. If I have ever, ever given the impression that I consider our children anything but blessings—
I don't mean it like that, he says quickly. I made a mistake, and I want to fix it now.
He looks at her.
I want to set you free.
Set me free? Or be rid of me?
Dalton says.
Maybe Casey and I should wait out.
Nancy doesn't seem to hear him.
I made a mistake. Not a mistake in what happened with Ellen. Maybe I should say that was wrong, but it was something I needed. The mistake was not telling you that I needed it and working out a solution together. If you want to leave, then I understand. But as for setting me free, she meets his gaze. You never held me captive. I could have left any time I wanted. I didn't want to.
I slide toward the exit, Dalton following, but Nancy stops us.
Yes, we apologize for making you bear witness to a very personal conversation, she says. But I have a feeling if you aren't here, this won't be resolved. You are our passage south. We need to decide this before you go.
That isn't true. We'll be back, but I understand what she's saying. They've avoided this conversation for over a decade, and if we're awaiting an answer, they can't push it aside again.
Do you want this? Nancy asks Tomas. If you do, then yes, we'll go south and start over in separate lives sharing our children. Because that last part is the most important. I'd never give them up, and I'd never ask you to. They are ours, whether we are together or not. But if you're offering me a way out of this marriage, the answer is no. I don't want that. If you're saying I can stay on the condition this never happens again, she meets his gaze. I cannot promise you that. I have no idea if it will or won't, and that is a very long conversation we need to have if we want to make this work. But I would like to make it work. You are my partner. You are my friend. You are my lover. Nothing has changed for me. With Ellen, I was answering a question about myself that I should have answered 12 years ago. And I don't know if I did. I found something I needed, but it didn't change what I already have. And I'm not sure what to make of that. I need time to work it through. If you can give me that.
Tomas nods. That's all he does. Wordlessly nods, his eyes glistening.
You want me to stay? She says.
Another nod and quiet.
Please.
Then the question is, do we stay?
And the answer, she exhales.
The answer is no. Not here. Not after all this. It will be too hard for the children, and really, that's just the excuse I think we needed to go. We'll remain for the winter, and then we'll decide our next step.
And now, in the midst of tragedy, I need to ask them a question unrelated to any of this. Oh, I kicked myself for not doing it earlier, but it isn't as if I'd forgotten the reason we were here, to find Abby's parents. Earlier, it had been clear that Nancy didn't realize Ellen had been trading goods to help Abby's mother, so I didn't see a lead there. Also, I'd suspected one of them might have murdered Ellen, so I hadn't been about to expose Abby's existence. Now, though, with Ellen's death unrelated to Abby, there's no reason not to ask. I ask with extreme care, hoping I won't seem too callous. Sorry your nephew murdered your friend and lover, but while I'm here, maybe you could help with this other case? It helps, of course, that the other case is a lost baby. It's hard to begrudge help with that. They are both horrified and relieved. Horrified that Lane almost accidentally killed an infant, and relieved that the child is safely in Rockton.
We had no idea, Nancy says. It makes sense, now that you've told us. Yes, she'd have wanted those scraps for diapers and the balm for breastfeeding. There were other items, too, and they all fit. She was helping a woman who'd born a winter baby.
As she would, Tomas says softly.
Nancy's eyes glitter with tears.
Yes, she would, absolutely.
I only wish she'd told us, if only so we could help you get that baby back to her mother. Oh, she must be going mad with worry. When we find Lane, he may be able to tell us what Ellen was doing or where she was coming from when he, she breaks off, her voice catching. Tomas reaches for her, hesitating a little, but she falls into his arms. We slip out after that, followed by Tomas's promise that they'll help us in any way they can. In return, we promise that we'll be back in a week or so to see whether they need help finding Lane. Then, we're gone. We rest back at our campsite. We must, considering how far we need to walk. A 4-hour nap before we break